Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. So much talk these days about the rise of China, and conversely, we hear talk about the decline of the West. Maybe we truly are on the verge of something, a crossroads, a juncture, a turning point. But before we race across any of those vast horizons, before we draw any epic conclusions about the current trajectory of global power, maybe it would be a bit helpful to have a firm grasp on just how Western society ascended to power in the first place. Our next guest has reason to believe that the first real momentum gained by the West before ascending to world dominance required that the scrawny and ineffectual leaders and societies of Europe find some kind of muscle to flex. Apparently, European entities were the unlikeliest of candidates for exerting any real sway on the world stage. Hapless, helpless, weak, feeble. But then, not really overnight, but in a relatively short span of a few decades, these societies in Europe acquired something like a critical mass. They acquired what I'm going to call proto-power, you know, that potential to grow into something more substantial and influential, eventually maybe even acquiring the capacity to take over most of the world and chart the course of the future. Patrick Wyman is with us, a writer, a historian, a creator of the hit podcast series Tides of History and Fall of Rome. Wyman is author of The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. Patrick, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I wonder if I could tempt you right off the beginning to make a confession that this story is too big for anybody to tell. Is that possible?
Yeah, I think many people have spent their entire lives trying to figure out precisely why the West has risen. It is the central historical question of the last 500 years, maybe longer, maybe a little bit shorter, depending on your perspective on things. But yeah, far more accomplished and dedicated people than I am have attempted to answer this series of questions. It's definitely too big for any individual person. The most you can try to do is get some perspective on it. And to try to understand what the question really is, what are we talking about here? And from my perspective too, how did this affect people who were living through unsettled times? That to me is the core of what my book is about. As much as it is about that big question itself, what is it like to live through a period of time that is full of upheaval, that sees your entire way of life being turned upside down in a relatively brief period of time?
So when I hear of accounts like this, I just fall back on the way I was taught history when I was a kid. And I'm old enough that this we're talking about, you know, the textbooks. Well, I wasn't reading textbooks that were, printed in the 70s and 80s because we got old textbooks. And so they were from the 60s. But you'd go to those usual suspects, the explorers, the kings, the scientists, the Columbus, the Da Vinci, you know, somebody the equivalent of a Caesar Augustus in the more modern world. Is there any way to tell this kind of a story and dodge those stereotypes, those big names?
So I'm of two minds about this because you definitely don't want to tell this story solely through big characters like that for a couple of different reasons. First of all, because you're simplifying the story. You are breaking down a variety of complex processes and you are giving all of the agency, all of the power to influence events to these big name folks. Now, even if they did have some agency, most of what happens in the world is not decided by the whims of kings and popes. It's everyday people going about their daily lives, deciding that they're going to plant their crops, they're going to sell their goods, they're going to go to church or not go to church, they're going to buy something that somebody has written that's been printed by a printing press. Those are the kinds of decisions that in the aggregate make up the human experience and that drive forward history. Now, we're confronted with the conundrum that it's very difficult to tell a series of compelling stories on the basis of people's everyday lives. It is very difficult to make plowing, planting, harvesting, to make that kind of stuff, which is what 80% of the populace in Europe was doing around 1500, to make that the stuff of really exciting stories. We're much more likely to gravitate toward kings, toward generals, toward popes, toward the kind of big dominating figures that exist at the top of a social hierarchy. And yet they aren't the ones who necessarily matter. They may matter more than any individual peasant, but not in the aggregate. So this is the tough part.
Yeah. I was going to say, I said scrawny, I said weak, I said feeble. I was talking about Europe in these years, and the span of years that you're talking about really does stretch from the dust jacket of your book from 1490 to 1530. And so how scrawny was Europe? I mean, how weak was Europe?
So in some ways, Europe was exceptionally advanced relative to the rest of the world. And the way in which it was exceptionally advanced had to do mostly with its command of financial tools. The level of economic sophistication and the ability to mobilize and use credit existed at every level of society all over Western Europe. But Western Europe was relatively poor in resources. At this point in time, it was not especially populous relative to the rest of the world. It's not like there were like a huge chunk of the world's population was residing in Western Europe. Technologically, it was not any more advanced than any part of the rest of the world at this point, or than say China. It wasn't more technologically advanced than India, than the Ottoman world. If it was kind of a backwater stuck at the edge of Eurasia, it was the very endpoint of all of the trade routes that united Europe, Africa, and Asia. So it's not that it's necessarily the backwater of backwaters. It's a relatively developed urban society by global standards at that point in time. But it's definitely not the place that if you were looking for what's going to be the area of the world that's going to dominate the globe over the coming centuries, you would not have said Western Europe. That would not have been at the top of your list.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about Gothic cathedrals, and those are kind of impressive, and those came a few centuries before.
Absolutely. It's not like Western Europe was full of tiny little mud huts and was incapable of producing monumental architecture or great kings or armies. I mean, obviously the Crusades were evidence of the fact that it was possible for Western Europeans to go out and exert political and military will over other parts of the world. But Western Europe was not a center of anything. There was a reason why it was Western Europeans going outward and not other people coming to Western Europe in search of valuable goods.
So if you had a few clairvoyant Nobel laureate types who were maybe around in 1490, and if they were going to finger some part of the world to really have world dominance, where would they be pointing?
I think you'd probably point to the Ottoman Empire. You would probably point to an expansive state that was centered on formerly Constantinople, then Istanbul, city of several hundred thousand people, one of the largest cities, if not the largest city in Europe, that was home to an advanced, highly developed state apparatus with a standing army full of professional soldiers that was a conquest state that was perfectly capable of going out and conquering its neighbors and assimilating them into an imperial structure. There was nothing like that happening in Western Europe. The Ottomans were the biggest empire game in town. Otherwise, you might point to Ming China in the New World. I mean, I think the city of Tenochtitlan, what's today Mexico City, at the heart of the Mexica or Aztec Empire, was an absolute wonder by any global standard at that particular point in time. By comparison, London, Paris are kind of muddy, run down. They're not exactly London in 1500 is not going to be above Constantinople on anybody's list of global destinations.
Yeah. Well, let's talk now about some of the people who had a hand in changing all of that. And you've already mentioned finance, so I think we ought to go to the story of Jakob Fugger or somebody like him who... they don't make a lot of headlines in history, at least not for the average reader.
Yeah, Jakob Fugger is one of my favorite characters in this book. He's commonly known, if he's known at all in the 21st century, as maybe the richest man who ever lived. Certainly the richest non-monarch. He was a banker who got his start working for his family firm in the South German city of Augsburg. The Fugger family dealt mostly in cloth. They were trading cloth from Venice to South Germany throughout the cities like Nuremberg, maybe a little bit on to the Low Countries, but they were cloth traders. There were a lot of families who were like the Fuggers. Within a couple of decades, though, the Fuggers had become the premier financiers of the premier state-building monarchs of Western Europe. So the Fuggers financed the purchase of the throne of the Holy Roman Empire for a guy named Charles V, who was the widest ruling European monarch since Charlemagne.
You're going to have to explain to us how you buy a throne, but I don't mean to interrupt you. When you're ready.
Absolutely.
When you're ready.
Yeah, okay. So this is one of the things when we think about, when we really dig into the nitty-gritty of how this period worked, you know, we tend to think of all-powerful ruling monarchs and people do what they say. That's not really how politics worked at this point in time. Kings ruled because people agreed that they could rule. That people agreed that they were legitimate, that they had the authority to tell other people what to do. And in the Holy Roman Empire, which took up most of what's now Central Europe, Germany, the Czech lands, places like that, the throne was elective. It was mostly held within a single family. By a family called the Habsburgs that you may have heard of, because they ruled the Austro-Hungarian Empire into the 20th century. But there are still Habsburgs around today. One of them was a member of the European Parliament, I'm pretty sure. So the Habsburg family provided the emperors, but they still had to be elected. And there were seven very powerful noblemen of the Holy Roman Empire who had votes. They're called electors. Now, the electors were probably going to vote for a Habsburg, but they needed to be convinced to do that. And the way that they were going to be convinced to do that was by the application of lots and lots and lots of money. That was not money that the future Charles V had on hand. That was money that he had to borrow, and he borrowed it from Jakob Fugger. So it was Jakob Fugger's money that bought the throne of the Holy Roman Empire for Charles V. It was Jakob Fugger's money that bought the armies that Charles used to fight other European monarchs incessantly. It was into Jakob Fugger's account books that the blood money from the Americas, from the conquest of the New World Empires, that money all eventually came back to Jakob Fugger. When we try to understand how and why things were happening in this period of time, figures like Jakob Fugger end up being really central to it. Even though we may think of finance as kind of a grubby or a hidden thing, it all comes back at the end of the day to Jakob Fugger, because people don't work for free, not even kings.
So, okay, you've used this term electors, and this is well before the emergence of democratic institutions. And so I'm just wondering if buying a throne by buying the votes, was that seen as corrupt in those days?
Not really, huh? It was part of politicking. It's kind of a misconception that in the Middle Ages, kings got to say something and everybody did what the king said. That's much more of a facet of what we would call absolutist rule, which is much more of a phenomenon of the 17th and 18th centuries, when you have an all-powerful monarch who stands at the very apex, whose word is unquestionably law. In the medieval world, and this is what the beginning of the 16th century is, kings really had to be pretty delicate, for the most part, about how they went about ruling, because they had constituents. These were not democratic societies, but there were stakeholders. There were people who got to have a say in how the kingdom was run, or thought they should. And if they weren't consulted, if the merchants of the most powerful city in the realm were subject to trade restrictions, well, they could withdraw their support. They could say, we don't think we're going to pay these taxes. We don't think we're going to give you loans to fight your wars. The great nobles of the land could always say, you know what? We don't think your claim to being king is actually all that good. Maybe one of us should be king instead. These were always things that rulers had to worry about. They had to worry about who was supporting them, about who they were angering with any particular action that they took. They had to worry about running out of money. So buying the votes of the electors of the Holy Roman Empire was very much par for the course. People had to be incentivized to support their rulers. It was not just a matter of, well, he's the king, we have to do what the king says. You could always find a reason to not obey the king if you didn't want to.
So I kind of hear a story emerging here that the root of all evil is also the root of all power, and that being money means that the financiers were the ones calling the shots.
Yeah, very much so. The financiers pretty much always found a way to get paid. I think more than anything else, to me, that is the big story of early modern history. To me, that's the story that makes the modern world what it is. It's that the financiers were always looking for reasonable rates of return, and the course of history reflects their quest for returns. So people like Christopher Columbus, Christopher Columbus was not out there, you know, working for the betterment of mankind. He was the representative of a commercial syndicate that had put money together to fund his voyage. He reported to financing merchants, most of whom were Genoese who lived in southern Spain, and people who were kind of investors who worked in and around the court of the Spanish rulers at the time. That was who Columbus was reporting back to, and what Columbus was trying to do on his voyages was find ways of making money to pay those people back. That's what it was about. That's where it was. War was a business too. It wasn't that people were out there fighting for king and country. It was that armies were made up of mercenaries who were going to get paid or were hoping that they were going to get paid for services rendered. That's what, when we think about the early modern period, when we think about how we end up with the world that we do, it's because of people like that and mechanisms like that.
So explorers would not have explored if speculators had not speculated.
That's exactly correct. Yeah. The one of my favorite anecdotes about Columbus is, so, you know, we always hear the Niña, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, right? Well, okay. So the Niña and the Pinta are caravels. They're these really handy ships that were developed to sail down the treacherous coast of West Africa by the Portuguese in the course of the 15th century. Well, the Niña and the Pinta were ships that were provided for Columbus's use by a seaport that had been dodging its taxes. So this seaport, a little town called Palos on the coast of southern Spain, they had not been paying their taxes to the Spanish crown for some time. And so a financier at the Spanish court gets the idea, well, okay, the people of Palos haven't paid their taxes. We've got this guy, Columbus. He's going to go sailing out there. We need ships for him. Okay, if they let Columbus use these two ships, the Niña and the Pinta, we'll call their tax bill good. And that's what was at those kinds of things, the idea of people getting paid back, of transferring one form of debt into another form. That's what's at the heart of all of these big developments in this period.
You know, I always like a good Martin Luther story, so I'm going to hit you up for one of those. We are visiting with Patrick Wyman. He's author of The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. The 40 years we're talking about go from 1490, a couple years before Columbus coming to the New World, and all the way to 1530. And so just to recap a little bit here, Patrick, these 40 years, to your mind, represent a certain window in which the dynamics of what was going on in Western Europe were such that the people there, the societies, the leaders, the politicians, the economies, everything there was getting into a new poise, into a position where within a century or so, Western Europe would become dominant.
Yeah. The way that I like to think about it is this period set the preconditions for that world. This period of time in 1490, the idea that Western Europe is going to be the heartland of global empires would seem laughable. By 1530, after about 40 more years, even if that future is still a ways off, you can see how you get there. That you can see the foundations of that future world that are starting to get built up. You can see how you might end up with a British Empire, with French territories in the New World, with a vast New World empire for Spain. You can see how you get there.
Yeah. Well, printing is going to play into this, and the convergence of printing also with religion is very interesting. And you've already established that the driver behind so much of this is the financial considerations of who's going to make a penny off of it. And so if we tell the Martin Luther story in very brief form, he has words, and his words get disseminated. He wants them to go around, and he wants to make his case, and that involves printing. And I guess religious tracts had become kind of profitable.
Yeah, that to me is the fundamental story of the Reformation. It's that Martin Luther, and the story of Martin Luther in particular, it's that Martin Luther turned out to be a marketable brand. Martin Luther, as it turned out, nobody would have thought an Augustinian monk who was teaching at an out-of-the-way university in Wittenberg, that he would turn out to have the kind of written style and breadth of talent necessary to become pretty much the first best-selling author in the print age. But as it turned out, that is really the story of the Reformation. The story of the Reformation getting off the ground is the story of Martin Luther, and the story of Martin Luther is the story of the printing press, because printers were always looking for some way of guaranteeing themselves a short-term return on investment. Most printing projects meant that you were going to have to wait years from the time when you commissioned the book to running the pages through your printing press, binding them, sending them out, finding the buyers paying your agents, and then you getting paid eventually for that. This was a years-long process, and there were a lot of ways that it could go wrong. If you underestimated or overestimated the size of the market, you could be left with a whole bunch of copies of a book that nobody wanted to buy. Just a horrible thing. But Martin Luther's work was mostly pamphlets. You would print these up. It would take you a couple of days, and they would sell immediately. So printers loved them because it meant that you were going to get paid right away. All you had to do was put aside your press for a couple of days. You put these things out there. People would buy them. You would have the money in hand, and you could move on to the next project. So as it turned out, the fact that Martin Luther was really good at writing these little short, fiery pamphlets that they were often decorated with woodcut images, that people wanted to buy them. And printers thought, well, if people are going to buy them, then we're going to print them. People bought them. They printed more and more and more and more. And so over the course of the early Reformation, Martin Luther is the one who's doing the vast majority of the writing. He's the one who's providing the vast majority of the works that people are reading. And so there's a commercial story that goes along with one of kind of religious reform and religious upheaval. There's a story of an industry that finds a figurehead that people are willing to buy. So as much as Martin Luther is and should be understood as a religious reformer, he's also the figure who leads to printing becoming a commercially viable thing. There was no guarantee that printed books were going to set the tone for the next five centuries in the early 16th century. Printing was still a new phenomenon, is still a new technology. And frankly, it was one that was still looking for a viable business model. And Martin Luther played a key role in making sure that printing had a viable business model, that it was going to be a technology that could survive and thrive.
Well, I'm imagining that the printers of those pamphlets were grateful that he had a way with words. You know, can I share a Martin Luther line with you?
Absolutely.
One of my favorite lines. It's not really theology at all. He was taking somebody to task. He was calling somebody a fool. And he said, he wrote this, and it appeared in print. You don't have to hear a jackass sing. You can recognize him by the ears.
That is incredibly on brand for Martin Luther. That's exactly the kind of reason why people wanted to read Luther. Nobody would have thought that, I mean, he's just an Augustinian monk. He's just a university professor. And it turned out that he had a gift for writing this incredibly punchy prose, exactly the kind of thing that you just read off there. That kind of stuff is typical for him. You can see why somebody would think, oh yeah, a Martin Luther pamphlet. I want to pick that up and I want to buy that and I want to read it. And so people are buying as much to be entertained by Martin Luther's newest insult for his many, many enemies as they were for the theological content. That's one of the fantastic and fascinating things about Luther. I mean, because he did have that way with words. In an era when people were kind of struggling to understand a more abstract approach to money and finance, Martin Luther called shares in a mine play money. He's like, that's not a real thing. I don't want to be paid in that. That's not real. It's not solid. I can't put my hands on it. And so the fact that he could connect with people on that kind of level, the fact that he knew when was the right time to put out an anecdote about a jackass, that speaks to his ability to connect to people.
So was he providing some of the saintly copy that corresponds maybe to like Pulp Fiction in more modern times?
Yeah, he's definitely the forerunner of it, because he's Martin Luther's, most of the things that he was producing were kind of ephemeral. You know, there a lot of the works that he produced don't survive in very many copies today because they weren't books. They were just the kind of thing that you'd pick up, you'd read, and then you might throw it away. You're not going to save a pamphlet. A lot of these things only exist today in a couple of copies, even if they were produced by the thousands and thousands and thousands, because you don't stick them on a shelf. You pick it up, you read it, it makes an impact on you, but then it goes away. It can be forgotten. Even his 95 theses, you know, we think about it as being a really big deal that he goes and he knocks it into the door of Wittenberg, of the castle church in Wittenberg. But that's just because that's what you did when you printed something out. And you wanted people to see it. Everything went up there. It would have been stuck between a town ordinance talking about the price of beer and a notice that that some itinerant traders were coming to town. That's the kind of world that Martin Luther's print output existed in. It's not necessarily that they were writing for some sort of posterity that was going to exist hundreds of years down the line, and that's what they were thinking about. It was very immediate.
Yeah, today, when somebody's missing a cat, you tape a picture of the cat to a telephone pole.
Exactly. And that's what most print was. We can easily lead ourselves astray when we think about print output as being these big, heavy, weighty tomes. That's not really what it was.
So is it okay? Money will buy a throne. Money will buy you pamphlets. Money is going to get you an explorer to take a ship to the Americas. Is it too reductive and is it too cynical to look at money as driving this chapter of history like so many others?
Well, so I think money drives a great many things. And I think to put a slightly different spin on it, the way that we pay for things has long-term lasting effects. So when you build a financial regime around debt and paying it back, that creates incentive structures, right? You have to, that incentivizes people to behave in particular ways. And the way you set up a voyage of exploration is such that the people who are going out there have to find some way of paying back the investors for the voyage because they want to get rich. The investors want to get rich and that's the job. Then you're going to be incentivized to do things like enslave the people that you find as a way of paying it back. If you are paying for an army, if you are financing an army of mercenaries on debt and then you can't pay them, you don't have the cash to pay them, that's how you end up with that army of mercenaries running out of control and sacking the city of Rome. Basically, it's not just about money. It's that the way that we use money and the way that we set up those systems of financing really shapes the way those systems work. The way it shapes the way that people made war. It shaped the way that those voyages of exploration took place. It shaped the structure of the printing industry. It incentivized printers to print these really punchy and often inflammatory things that Martin Luther had to say. So the way that these industries were set up and the way that they all revolved around these like debt heavy models of financing, it meant that people were going to be incentivized to take things a step further. It meant that once you started seeing returns on these things, that they could scale very quickly. I think we see that in the present day too, that when you see a brand new industry, that is profitable, money pours in, money follows, money follows, money follows money. And, that allows companies like Uber, right, to completely disrupt a massive, long established market in, you know, kind of on-call transportation, right? In the course of a few years, you can completely upend that industry. I think you see the same thing here.
Are you saying that in Western Europe, the conventions and the habits of investors and creditors of offering loans and people accruing debt, that these practices were in some ways unique to Europe?
So I think that the combination of, yes, I think that the extent to which they were absolutely everywhere is unique, that they exist at every social level, that people are thinking in terms of money. Even when they're not dealing in money, they're thinking in terms of the monetary value of objects, of services. They're always thinking in these terms. So I think it's not that you couldn't find this anywhere else, but it's the combination of that way of thinking plus the incentives to go out and do things like fund voyages of exploration, the incentives for kings to fight one another for territory and prestige. So the availability of the mechanisms plus the incentives driving people onward, I think those two things play together very neatly because you can have the mechanisms, but if you don't have any reason to use them, then it's not going to get you anywhere. If you have the incentives but not the mechanisms, that doesn't get you anywhere. It's the combination of those things and the way that they're interacting with one another that gets you to the final point.
So if it's a Habsburg ruler by the name of Charles, and he goes to a Jakob Fugger and he says, get me the crown of the Holy Roman Empire and put it on my tab, that's kind of the same as saying, for a peasant to go into a pub and say, I need a drink, but I don't have any money.
Yeah, it's the exact same way of thinking about money. It's the exact same mechanism that lies at the root of both of those, because you have both. Everybody wants to provide the service, right? Like the innkeeper who's selling the ale wants that peasant to get a drink, because that means that down the road that innkeeper is going to get paid for it, that he's going to have somebody in his debt. Jakob Fugger wants Charles to have the throne because that's yet another source of income for him down the road. So it's the ability to think about the future return on investment that's present at all social levels here that I think is really foundational. Yeah.
So is there a comparison to be made then between what Western Europe is doing along these lines and what's happening, say, in the Ottoman Empire, so that the Ottoman Empire is eclipsed?
Yeah, it's one of those necessity is the mother of invention type things that if you were asking Charles V, would you rather have Suleiman the Magnificent's treasury, which was overflowing? Suleiman didn't need to take out huge, constant, ongoing loans either to buy his throne or to fight his wars. He had the money to do it. So that meant that in the short term, much better for the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was expanding throughout the first half of the 16th century, and while Western Europe was mostly on the defensive when compared to the Ottoman world. But down the road, it meant that the Ottomans never had to develop these incredibly sophisticated fiscal mechanisms to ensure that the money kept pouring in. The Ottomans turned to much shorter term ways of accruing and repaying debt, things like tax farming, which in the short term got you the funds, but in the long term, they could be really damaging. They weren't sustainable methods of financing, but that's a matter of like, you know, it's like a butterfly flapping its wings and causing a hurricane hundreds of miles away. When you're looking at it centuries down the road, nobody could have seen that coming. Charles V would have much rather had Suleiman's treasury than his own. He would have much rather not had to deal with Jakob Fugger and just thought, oh yeah, I've got all of these tax revenues coming in. I can pay my soldiers. This is fantastic. I can do what I need to do.
Suleiman, Karl or Charles V, Martin Luther, Christopher Columbus, all of these characters, Jakob Fugger that you talk about in your book, is there a way that you can skirt the whole issue as to whether or not you like any of them?
I'll put it to you this way. I don't think much of a lot of them. And I think that, so this comes back to something that you asked about at the very beginning, how do we tell the story of the past without it solely being about the actions of great men. And I think the first way that you do that is by thinking that the great men were not really all that great to start with, right? That a lot, it's not like Charles V in particular was not a genius. He was a deeply ordinary member of the noble class who happened to be sitting on a whole variety of thrones simultaneously. But there was nothing about Charles personally that was all that outstanding. Christopher Columbus was a pretty typical kind of guy for his time and place. He had traveled maybe a bit further than most. He maybe had a faster mouth on him. But in terms of his mental gifts or his vision, it's not like he was an outstanding figure. And that's true of a lot of the people that we label as great, is that they're either typical and just happen to be in the right place at the right time, or in fact, they're actually not that outstanding at all. And I think when we can decouple the fact that we know who these people are, that we've heard their names over and over again, from any sense of their worth, that gets as either in a moral or a historical sense, then that gets us a lot closer to understanding how and why things actually happen in history. We don't have to think that kings are great people, just like we don't have to think that presidents are great people, to get a sense for what their role is and how they shape the course of history.
Patrick Wyman, a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Patrick Wyman and his book titled The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. There's a character who gets a full chapter in The Verge. We didn't get to talk about him beyond the briefest mention, but we're going to make up for that. You could say this fellow was the inventor of the paperback, not the cheap kind with a racy cover. I'm talking about a man who took the very best books of Western civilization out of the library, the monastery, the university, and put them within reach of just about anybody's hands, even poor college students. And his name was Aldus Manutius. He lived in Italy as Europe tipped on the verge, and our next guest kind of sees him as the Steve Jobs of that era. I'm Marcus Smith. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. This is Constant Wonder. In the early days of printing, more and more people were coveting the opportunity to learn. Books were scarce, so when one Italian printer set out to put classics within reach of just about everybody into the pockets of the middle class, this was a revolutionary act. His name was Aldus Manutius. And to get the story about him, I spoke with G. Scott Clemens, author of Aldus Manutius, A Legacy More Lasting Than Bronze.
The challenge in the late 15th century is that books were very expensive. They were very large. They were typically printed in what's called a folio format. So you and I couldn't afford them. The church could afford them. The aristocracy could afford them. But you stood in their presence. You could barely turn them in your hands. So perhaps the biggest contribution he made to the world of classical literature was that he printed them in smaller formats, a format we're very familiar with today, the sort of paperback format, an octavo format, something you can put in your pocket or a purse or a briefcase, and you can actually have them and turn them in your hands. This was Aldus's big contribution, was simply to print these things smaller. He wasn't the first to print smaller books, but prior to Aldus, smaller books were for things like devotionals and books of hours. And Aldus essentially asked, why shouldn't you have a personal, intimate relationship with Virgil or Euripides or Horace in very much the same way that you do with something more theological in nature? And here, too, I think there was both a humanistic impulse, how do we put great literature into the hands of students and poorer scholars? I think there was also a commercial impulse. If I accomplish this, I will make more money. He was right on both counts.
Well, it sounds like he's kind of a master of distribution, and now I'm thinking about Steve Jobs for some reason. You know, it's the idea that we're going to figure out the mechanism for disseminating all kinds of, I'm going to call it data, but maybe back then it was learning or information. Is that comparison too stretched?
No, I don't think it is. And I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll stretch it even further. In the same way that Steve Jobs had such a keen eye for design, both outside a machine and inside a machine, so did Aldus. I think he was a perfectionist, and it shows up in the quality of the books. They were highly collectible 500 years ago, because the beauty of typography, the quality of the paper, and yes, the quality of the content and the quality of the editing, but as a physical artifact, his imprints were things of beauty in the same way that Steve Jobs very much wanted any Apple product to be regarded as a thing of beauty and utility. Aldus, I think, accomplished both. And I think the dolphin and the anchor logo sort of speaks to that. There's the story behind that. We know the story again from Erasmus, who relates that in 1501, Aldus's good friend Pietro Bembo gave Aldus a copy of that denarius minted during the reign of the Emperor Titus with a dolphin and anchor on it, and suggested to Aldus that that image perfectly captured what his twin objectives were. The dolphin symbolizing speed of production, but the anchor symbolizing stability of purpose. And the Latin motto that was associated with that became festina lente, make haste slowly. Go as fast as you can, but no faster than you need to in order to accomplish with quality what you set out to do. Aldus embraced that, and he's known for that to this day.
So he's a great designer in what senses, in terms of not just the mechanism of these smaller books, but it also comes out that he's just the basics of typesetting and making it look good as a craft?
Yes, in three ways. The first of which is in Roman type, the type that we read today 95% of the time. And indeed, his real contribution there took place in another very small publication printed, it's undated, but probably printed about 1496, that is a travel narrative. It was a job print. He was paid to print it by this individual, Pietro Bembo, whom I've already referred to. And so any font today that you pull up in Microsoft Word or anywhere that has the name Bembo in it, B-E-M-B-O, is a direct descendant of what Aldus printed in the late 15th century. The big development in typography became in 1500 and 1501, where Aldus basically took the Roman type and slanted it a little bit. A typeface that was known as Aldine type until the middle of the 19th century, we know today as italic. Aldus invented that. The first book printed in italic type was in 1501. It was the collected works of Virgil. So we owe italic type to Aldus as well. And perhaps a little bit more obscure, Aldus's developments in Greek typography, not nearly as common today, obviously, but his developments in Greek typography were essential to the preservation of the Greek language, because he was able to print Greek in a clear enough way that a student or a scholar could learn it without wrestling with all the complexities that ancient Greek brings to bear on letter forms.
I just want to go back and savor a phrase you used. I love a little bit of Latin now and then, and festina lente, you said. That's, yes, I think, what we call an oxymoron, right? To make haste, yes, but slowly.
Yes.
Why would a printer latch on to that, this symbol of the dolphin and the anchor? I get that it works, but those are, you know, not exactly oil and water, but maybe they are.
Mm-hmm. I think Aldus, this is a bit of an anachronism, but I'm going to use the metaphor anyway because it comes to mind. Aldus heard a ticking clock of the loss of classical literature, and he felt driven to preserve it, and he felt like he had to do everything that he could in what little time God gave him on this earth to accomplish that. And it shows up again and again in the prefaces he wrote. We're very lucky. This was not unique to Aldus, but at the time, printers would often write a preface to their readers, ad lectori, in any publication that they made. And the one that strikes me as the most compelling, in 1513, Aldus printed the first edition of Plato, text that otherwise could have been lost. Imagine a world in which Plato was, to us, nothing but a name, and we knew nothing of the Republic. How impoverished would that world be? In the preface to the 1513 first edition of Plato, printed only a year before Aldus died, he said to his readers, he said, "There are some men today who consider me a modern-day Hercules, because despite all the difficulties and all the dangers, I have made greater contributions to the cause of letters than any other person for many ages past. And this has entitled me, Aldus, that is, to their esteem, and they wear me out with their praise." And you read this and you think to yourself, wow, this guy is really high on himself.
Yeah.
And he pauses, and then he says, "But I don't believe them, nor have I ever yet published a book which has pleased me, with which I have been pleased. Such is the regard that I bear to literature, that I wish to make these books, which are intended for the use of scholars, not only as correct, but as beautiful as possible." And as a testament, as a milestone of the Renaissance approach to both beauty and accuracy and clarity, it's hard for me to read that without tearing up almost a little bit, because here is someone who was monomaniacally dedicated to making sure that this literature was preserved, but done so in a very accurate and beautiful way, hence the dolphin and hence the anchor together.
Well, I just have to ask you, Scott Clemens, because you're trained in classics at Princeton, I believe?
Princeton, that's right.
Yeah. And so you are going to come with a long life now of having a reverence towards the intellects of the past. So you're going to be, you and Aldus are in the same choir, you know, Aldus Manutius. You believe the same thing, that we should have some kind of I'm going to say reverence, to the point that if you're going to transmit the wisdom of the past, the literature of the past, the culture of the past, from ancient Greece, from Rome. Why not put it in beautiful form and print it well? That whole sentiment, that whole worldview, actually, that worldview, man, we're in a place with, what do we call it? When you make a device and it's supposed to wear out quick, you know?
Obsolescence.
Designed obsolescence.
Yeah.
we're a consumer society. We're a throwaway society. You're kind of antiquated here.
Well, thank you, I think. I think about this is just a technological evolution, a paradigm shift. Go back long enough ago, the way in which information was captured and preserved and transmitted is we sat around a campfire at the end of the day and told stories. And then at some point, we began writing those things down, probably in the 7th or 8th century BCE. In the 15th century, with Gutenberg and Aldus, we began printing them. We're simply going through another paradigm shift today to more of an electronic methodology of capturing, preserving, and transmitting information. What's interesting about all those paradigm shifts is that they never obviate the previous paradigm. They change the way we use it. We still tell stories around a campfire. We still write things down longhand. We will still print things in books. What I worry about, and here's where I think I am a bit antiquated, this technological paradigm is not as robust as people believe that it is. I mean, you and I and many of your listeners will know every once in a while you clean out a desk drawer and you find an old pack of floppy disks back when disks actually flopped. Whatever's on those disks is practically useless. It's gone unless you have the technology with which to retrieve it. The 500-year-old books that sit on my shelf, if you can read the language, you can open them and read them today. They boot right up. Battery life is infinite. They're certainly subject to insects and fire and smoke and water and all those things. Nothing is perfect. But the technology of printing on paper turns out to be a pretty durable way of preserving and transmitting and collecting information. A metaphor that I use a lot, you've read about these seed banks that are built usually up in the Arctic tundra or somewhere where we stockpile seeds against some future potential global calamity, be it climate change or whatever. I think of a library of books, of real printed books, as a cultural seed bank against some future unknown, unpredictable cultural calamity in which we will need to go back and re-access the information and the knowledge of the ancients. And by ancients, I don't mean just the Greek and Latin ancients, but the ancients of the 19th, 18th, 17th centuries in multiple cultures. That's why libraries are so important today, real libraries.
Yeah, you know, there is something I heard once that Cicero was supposed to have said, all you really need in life, and this is a paraphrase, all you really need in life is a garden and a library. And when I think about
paraphrase, yeah.
Gardens and libraries, what do they have in common? They've got these leaves. Books can have leaves. But
yeah.
I think about, I guess the seed is the thing that connects it. The seed contains the information that can be preserved over time, and maybe it can germinate later. So you've got this kind of organic thing going on, and that just kind of is exciting to me.
It can replicate. And I will parenthetically say that BYU itself, in addition to having a fabulous library, BYU has a very deep, very good collection of books printed by the Aldine Press. And BYU did an exhibition, I want to say back in the early 1990s, maybe 1994, 1995, of their own holdings of the publications of the Aldine Press. So for Aldine scholars who travel to institutional libraries, BYU is actually high on the list of places to go to study this press.
So if you go into a museum or you come to BYU and look at the special collections, wherever you happen to be, you're holding something from the Aldine Press, if they let you hold it in your hand.
And they will.
Do you see that as you're holding it as I just don't see you looking at that and saying this is a museum piece the way we usually think of those things.
Well, they're meant to be used, and the whole definition of a book, it's meant to be used and it's meant to be portable. Books are immigrants. They travel. They move from library to library, from country to country, and hand to hand. What I'm particularly interested in as a collector is how that motion takes place and who uses them. So there are certainly some collectors who will want a copy of a book that looks pristine, as if it came off of the printing press yesterday. To me, that's more of a museum piece. There's a sterility to that. I would much rather have a volume that's been used, where there's underlining and there's marginalia and there's doodles on the page. And that, to me, lives and it breathes and it's an insight. It's almost a time machine into the way in which former owners and readers of these books have corresponded with them. And I believe if I do my job as a collector, and it's really a commitment of stewardship, not ownership, that future generations will similarly be able to learn from, not only enjoy, but also learn from the books that I have. So, no, they're meant to be used. And most, I'd say all rare book libraries welcome that use, not only from scholars, but just interested people in the history of our culture and the history of our species.
I want to tie a bow on this conversation, going back to the metaphor of the seed, if I can. You talked about books, these books, and the Aldus Manutius, the Aldine books, being sort of seed banks. You compare them to the seed banks up in Norway. I think one of the greatest proofs that these books are important and have changed civilization and will continue to be important to civilization is the sheer distance they've come. Do you ever just reflect on the dissemination of these artifacts that Aldus's books have made it from Venice to where you are and clear out here to Utah? That's a long distance.
They travel quickly. One of the items in my collection is actually, interestingly, not a genuine Aldine. It's a fake. It's a forgery. But done in about the year 1503. So highly was Aldus regarded that there were knockoffs, the equivalent of sort of fake Louis Vuitton handbags on the street corner, even when he was still alive and printing, usually done in France, in Lyon. This book happens to have been bound in Cambridge, England, and we know that because the binding itself is signed by a known Cambridge binder. Binders often use waste, sort of printing and manuscript waste, as filler in their book. And in the copy that I have of this particular book, the filler in it is from a German printing from the 1470s or 1480s. The Cambridge binder himself was a Dutchman. So in this one book, we have a French forgery of an Italian original bound by a Dutchman living in England using German waste papers in 1503. Five countries worth of, if you will, fingerprints on that single physical artifact. So yes, they move all the time. And that to me is just utterly fascinating how they get used and what that says about the way we interact with information and knowledge.
G. Scott Clemens, author of Aldus Manutius, A Legacy More Lasting Than Bronze. The Loneliest Polar Bear may sound like a charming board book for toddlers, but actually it's the real-life story of a desperate effort to save a starving, abandoned polar bear cub. There's a happy ending, but it's not a bedtime story. We'll bring it to you tomorrow here on our show. Meanwhile, check out the website justserve.org and join with us in 10,000 acts of service. Justserve.org has a plentiful array of volunteer opportunities to learn about. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.